This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Psychology 1, Tales and Wisdom from Duck Dynasty's Favorite Uncle by Cy Robertson with Mark Schlabach. Read by Jay Stone with Cy Robertson.
You can't spell squirrel without S-I, and that's me. Prologue. My parents absolutely ruined me. One of the lessons they always preached was to tell the truth no matter what. The Bible says we should always be honest, and that's one of the virtues I've tried to live by. I grew up to be an honest man who always told the truth to my teachers, coaches, sergeants, and bosses. Hey, I was like George Washington. I could never tell a lie. I can't even cross my fingers behind my back, Jack. I believe lying is a learned skill. Some people are good at it, while others aren't. I've always been a lousy liar. The key to being a good liar is to know when you can get away with it and when you can't. You have to keep a straight face if you're going to lie, and I could never stop smiling when I tried. My palms would get sweaty, and I'd lose my composure and start to stutter. Hey, I even grew a long beard so people couldn't call me a bald-faced liar. Still, as much as I tried, I couldn't tell a lie. My older brother Phil always told me that my nose would grow longer than Pinocchio's if I was ever dishonest, and I figured my nose was already big enough. Some people are great at lying. Poker players are great liars, and most politicians will never get elected if they can't lie. Hey, how do you know if a politician is lying? His lips are moving. Some great Americans were undone by not telling the truth. Bill Clinton, Richard Nixon, Lance Armstrong, Mark McGuire, the guys from Milli Vanilli, and Pete Rose, to name a few. I don't want to end up like them, so I always tell the truth. Hey, do you know what happens to a liar when he dies? He lies still, Jack. My 24 years in the Army would have been much easier if I'd only told a couple of white lies. I got myself into so much trouble in the military by simply telling the truth. I was passed over for promotions and given crummy assignments because I was always honest. If I'd only told a few lies, I might have left the Army as a 4-star general. Well, I'm always honest, so I have to tell you about the time I tried to tell a lie while I was in the Army. Hey, even the best of us slip up every once in a while. During my first year in Vietnam, I actually tried to lie to my commanding officer. I was extremely homesick and was desperately trying to get a furlough back to the United States. One day, I walked into my sergeant's tent. "Sir, may I have a word with you?" I asked very politely. "What is it, Private Robertson?" he said. "Well, sir, my wife is extremely ill, and the doctors can't figure out what's wrong with her," I said. "I really need to fly back to Louisiana to check on her. I think she might die." "Robertson, I have some good news for you," he said. "We received a telegram this morning from your wife, and she's been released from the hospital. Everything's going to be fine. There's no reason for you to go home." I scratched my head in disbelief. "Sir, with all due respect, I have to tell you that we must be the two biggest liars in Vietnam," I said. "I don't even have a wife." "Hey, if I've learned anything from being a part of Duck Dynasty, it's that you can't believe everything you see or read. It always amazes me that if people see something on television or read it on the internet, they instantly believe it's true. I remember going to church on a Sunday morning not long ago, and a little old lady walked up to me before service started. 'Si, I'm so sorry to hear about your vision,' she said. 'Hey, what are you talking about?' I said. 'My vision is perfect. It's 40/20. "No, you're blind, honey," she said. "I saw it on TV. It was on Duck Dynasty." Hey, no matter what I told the lady, she thought I was blind. She even asked me if I needed to be escorted to a pew. When Phil and I were making an appearance last summer, a pretty lady walked up to our table and said, "Here I am." "Who are you?" I asked. I'm the lady that just drove 350 miles to marry you, she said. I'm ready. Let's go. Well, that's an interesting proposal, but there's someone I know who might object. Who's that? She asked. Hey, I'm sorry, darling, I said, but I've been happily married for more than 40 years. I don't think my wife would like it if I got hitched to you, too. You mean I drove all this way for nothing, she said? Would you at least sign these T-shirts? Hey, you wouldn't believe the number of marriage proposals I get every week. Women send me letters, cards, emails, flowers, razors, and candy. For some reason, the women across America think I'm an eligible bachelor. Hey, sorry, ladies, I've been married since 1971. It amazes me what people will say about you sometimes. A few months ago, the phone started ringing at my house one afternoon. All of my relatives and friends started calling me to make sure I wasn't dead. People were even calling Phil's house to make sure I was okay. Apparently, someone had advertised that I would be appearing at a festival in Louisiana. When a bunch of people showed up to see me and I wasn't there, one of the vendors at the festival told them that I had been killed in a car wreck. Naturally, everybody thought I was dead. The news of my tragic demise spread like wildfire across the internet. Hey, newsflash people, I'm still here. Look, as you listen to this book, there are a few things that you have to understand. 95% of my stories are truthful. Every member of the Robertson family has the God-given gift of storytelling. Hey, when you sit in a duck blind for more than half of your life, you have to figure out some way to pass the time. It's better than looking at Willie and Jace for 6 hours. Many of the stories I like to tell happened when I was a young boy or when I was in Vietnam. My family members shared some of the stories over the dinner table, and other soldiers in Vietnam passed some of them on to me. At my age, a few of the details are cloudy, but I recollect the coming stories as best as I can. Hey, just remember, it isn't a lie if you think it's true. It's up to you, the listener, to figure out what's true and what's fiction. Best of luck with that, Jack. May the force be with you. Hey, another thing you have to know. My stories are kind of like my vocabulary. You might have noticed I like to say hey quite a bit. Hey can mean anything. It can mean yes, it can mean maybe, and it can mean no. Hey, it could mean next week. The bottom line is, you have to understand hey to understand me. And if you know anything about Silas Merritt Robertson, you know I'm a hard rascal to figure out. The naked truth is much better than the best-dressed lie. And now I'm going to pass it along to my nephew-in-law and longtime hunting partner, Jay.
Chapter 1. Birthday Suit. Like every other human on Earth, I came into this world in the buff. According to my brothers and sisters, I stayed that way throughout much of my early childhood. For whatever reason, I never liked to wear clothes when I was a boy, so I ran around our farm butt naked. I guess I figured since God brought me into this world in my birthday suit, I might as well wear it. Hey, some people have it, and some people don't. I've always had it, Jack. When I was born on April 27, 1948, my parents, Merritt and James Robertson, were living in a log cabin outside of Vivian, Louisiana. The cabin was really rustic. We used an outhouse and didn't even have hot water to take baths. I was the youngest of 5 sons. Jimmy Frank was the oldest boy, followed by Harold, Tommy, and Phil. I had an older sister, Judy, and then my younger sister, Jan, came along a few years after I was born. Our log cabin sat on top of a hill and was surrounded by about 400 acres. Marvin and Irene Hobbs, Mama's brother-in-law and sister, lived at the bottom of the hill. They had several kids, Billy, Mac, Sally, and Daryl, who were our first cousins. When Mama and Daddy played dominoes at the Hobbs's house, Jimmy Frank was put in charge of the younger kids. Our cabin became a prison, and Jimmy Frank was the warden. He'd walk outside the cabin as if on patrol, making sure none of the younger kids escaped, so we always called him the warden. We younger kids wanted to go to the Hobbs's house to play with our cousins. but Jimmy Frank was under strict orders to keep us inside. There were only two windows in the cabin, and they were our routes of escape. As the warden marched around the log cabin, one of us captives would watch him through the cracks in the walls. When he made his way around the right corner of the house, we'd all jump through the window and run down to the Hobbs's place. At least there weren't any sirens when we made our getaway. My daddy started working in the oil industry when he was young, first as a roughneck, then as a driller and tool pusher, and eventually he became a drilling superintendent. It was really hard work, but I never heard him complain about it. It was an honest living, and even though we never had a lot of money, we always had enough food to eat, which mostly came from the fields and gardens on our farm. And with so many kids around, we were never bored and always seemed to find something to keep us busy. When I was a little bit older, we left the log cabin and moved to Dixie, Louisiana, which is about 14 miles north of Shreveport. We made the move because Mama suffered a nervous breakdown and was diagnosed as manic depressive. Living in Dixie made it easier for her to get the treatment she needed. She spent a lot of time in hospitals and the state mental institution. I loved my mama dearly, and my brothers and sisters always say I was her favorite child. Hey, what can I say? I've always had that effect on women. A lot of my fondest childhood memories occurred in Dixie. I can still remember the day we drove to our house for the first time. We unloaded out of a 1957 Chevrolet and a couple of kids from the neighborhood walked up. We introduced ourselves to the boys, and the only way I can describe them is, well, they were geeks. We wandered around the yard, exploring the place, and noticed a big patch of woods about 2 miles from the railroad tracks in front of our house. We asked the boys, "Hey, what's over there?" "We have no idea," they told us. "What do you mean you have no idea?" I asked them. "Have you not been over there?" "No, we've never been over there," one of them said. The next thing they knew, Tommy, Phil, and I were racing across the railroad tracks and into the woods. We drove the farmers around our house slap insane by hunting on their land without permission. One of the farmers loved to chase us out of the woods in his pickup truck. Every time we heard his pickup coming, we'd take off running like a deer through the woods. We hid behind logs and in underbrush, looking for his truck at the top of a hill or in the pecan orchard. It was like Wile E. Coyote chasing the roadrunner. He never did catch us. Years later, we found out that chasing us was one of the farmer's favorite things to do. Mama sold Avon Cosmetics for a while, and one day she was at the farmer's house selling products to his wife. Mama apologized to the farmer for our hunting on his land, but he told her we were allowed to hunt on any of his property. Mama thanked him and was getting ready to walk out the door. "Hey, wait a minute," he said. "Don't tell them." "Well, you gave them permission," she said. "Oh, yeah, they can hunt on all my land whenever they want," he said. "But don't tell them I gave them permission. If they know they have permission, they won't run from me." That farmer loved the chase. We ran from him for about 15 years and didn't even have to. Phil, Tommy, and I were always hunting or fishing. One of the best things we did happened when the sun went down. When Phil was 10 years old, he got an air rifle for Christmas. I was 8 and got a Daisy BB gun. We spent every day going around the neighborhood shooting anything we could kill. When the sun went down, we got our flashlights and shined them under the awnings over the windows of our neighbors' houses. Birds loved to fly up there and go to sleep. Guess what? We loved to shine our flashlights on the birds and shoot them. Every night, our neighbors would be awakened by the clank, clank, clank sounds. Imagine their surprise when they opened the curtains and saw a bare-bottomed gunman.
I like a dog that fits my personality. Well-groomed, handsome, a natural-born killer, and one that doesn't mind taking a nap once in a while.
Chapter 2. Dynamic Dog Duo. Mark Twain once said, "The difference between a cat and a lie is that a cat only has 9 lives. Hey, let me tell you something. Where I grew up, cats didn't have 9 lives. They generally had just one. There weren't many second chances when the Robertsons were involved. We always had a lot of animals around our house, whether it was chickens, cows, pigs, rabbits, or horses, but I had 2 favorite family pets. Mamie was a Wiedemeyer, or a Weimaraner, as they call them, and she was a good hunting dog. Bullet was a cur, a Louisiana Catahoula leopard dog, which is a fancy way of saying she was a mutt. The breed is actually named after Catahoula Parish on the Ouachita River, which runs in front of the house where Phil and Kay live today. The Catahoulas are believed to be the first dogs bred in North America. Some people even suspect that Native Americans bred their dogs with the Molossers and Greyhounds that Hernando de Soto brought to Louisiana in the 16th century. Curs really aren't true hounds, but they're great hunting dogs and terrific at tracking wild boar. Many of them have spotted coats, and nearly all of them have distinctive marbled glass eyes. Bullet had 1 glass eye and a black and yellow coat. We always knew our toast was perfect when it was the color of Bullet's coat. I remember the day Bullet died. A truck hit him on the road in front of our house. Phil and I saw it and were crying as we climbed onto the school bus. By the time we got to school, everybody on the bus was crying, and then everybody in our class was crying. All the kids knew Bullet because they were always hanging out at our house. Mamie was a much bigger dog than Bullet and had a slick silver coat. Now, one of the problems with the Weimaraner breed is that the dogs are typically stubborn and not very smart. But Mamie was quite the exception. Not only would she listen to our commands, she would even talk to us on occasion. In fact, Mamie was Mama's alarm clock when we were young. Every morning, Mama would wake up early to cook us breakfast before we left for school. While Mama was cooking eggs, bacon, and buttermilk biscuits, she talked to our dogs. "How are you this morning?" she would ask them. "Are you having a good day?" Even though none of us believed her, Mama insisted the dogs talk back to her. When it was time for us to wake up for breakfast, Mama would send Mamie to our room. "Okay, wake them up," Mama told her. Mamie liked to leap into our beds and put her cold, wet nose on our faces to wake us. Once she received Mama's command, she'd take off running around the corner in the kitchen and then sprint down the long hall to our beds. Most of the time, we heard Mamie's claws scratching the hardwood floors before she jumped on our beds. This was our fair warning to pull the quilts over our heads. Our house was always cold in the winter. There were only a few floor heaters scattered through the shotgun house, and Mamie's nose was ice cold after being outside. Once Mamie found an opening in the blankets, she'd root her way under them, and there we were, jumping out of bed. It was impossible to keep Mamie out of the house. When we tried to put her outside, she'd open the front door. I guess she learned to open it by watching us turn the doorknob. She finally realized she could do it with her paws. When Mamie was ready to come inside, we'd hear scratching on the doorknob, and then she'd waltz into the front room. By the time we moved from the log cabin to our house in Dixie, Louisiana, Jimmy, Frank, and Harold were in school at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. One night, Tommy, Phil, and I were sitting at the dinner table with Paul and Granny. That's what we called my parents after their first grandchildren were born. It was one of the rare occasions when Mamie was outside. As soon as we started eating dinner, the front door opened and Mamie came running in. She looked at Mama and growled something I didn't understand. "What did she say?" Mama asked us. "I think she just said, 'Harold is home.'" A couple of minutes later, we heard a car door shut and then Harold walked in through the front door. My brothers and I were dumbfounded. Nobody said anything as we looked at each other. "Hey, I've been telling you I talk to her all the time," Mama told us. "And she talks back to me." Finally, I believed her. When Daddy worked as a driller, he was on the graveyard shift and some of his workers would occasionally come to our house before their shift. One night, one of our distant cousins, Wade Childs, was sitting in a dark green chair next to the fireplace. He didn't know it was Mamie's bed. Our front door was glass, so we could see through it from top to bottom. Wade was facing the door and saw the knob turning. Since it was nighttime, he couldn't see Mamie because of her dark coat. Wade must have thought a ghost was opening the door. His eyes got bigger and bigger, and then Mamie walked through the door. She walked straight toward him and sat in front of the chair. Then she started growling at him. She didn't bark. It was only a low growl in her throat. "Merritt!" Wade screamed. "Merritt!" Mama walked in from the kitchen and asked him what was wrong. "I didn't do anything," he said. "Oh, you need to get out of her chair," Mama told him. "She's telling you she's ready to go to bed." Wade got out of the chair, and Mamie jumped into it. She sneezed and spun around 3 times before taking a seat. Before Mamie started to snore, I swear I heard her say, "Sleep tight and don't let the bedbugs bite." Whenever we went hunting and fishing, Bullet and Mamie were always with us. They were great at retrieving ducks, doves, quails, squirrels, or whatever other game we were hunting. But Mamie had more of a thirst for blood. Every morning, when we went outside to wait for the school bus, Bullet and Mamie would sit and wait with us. Bullet would lie down on the ground, but Mamie would run across the railroad tracks in front of our house into a big mess of dewberry bushes. She wouldn't be gone 3 minutes, but always came back with a rabbit in her mouth. She did it every morning, Monday through Friday, without exception. Mamie would come back, lie down, eat the head off the rabbit, and leave the rest. Don't know why she didn't eat the body, but that's what she did. Every day when we came home from school, Mama would tell us to get the rabbit carcass off the front porch. I knew rabbits liked briar patches, but I couldn't believe how many rabbits were over there. Bullet was named exactly right because he was fast. He was like a cheetah chasing antelope running through the woods. Mamie was a bigger dog than Bullet and wasn't quite as swift. Together, though, they were the dynamic duo and the greatest cat-killing team I've ever seen. Bullet was adept at getting in front of a cat and keeping its attention while Mamie would sneak up from behind and pounce. She would break its neck before she was ever clawed. Bullet was fast, but he wasn't as quick as a cat. There were several times he came home covered with cat scratches. Our friend Tommy McKenzie's grandmother, Mrs. Wilson, lived next door to us in Dixie. Purple jasmine grew over the back door of her house. When it bloomed, it was beautiful and you could smell the flowers all the way from our house. Mrs. Wilson also had 40 Siamese cats. Now, I'm not much of a cat person, but I have to admit her cats were something to look at. Their coats had different colors and she spent a lot of time grooming them. Hey, when I left to join the Army at 19, Mrs. Wilson had only 2 cats left. Bullet and Mamie killed nearly every one of them. The lone survivors lived at the top of a big walnut tree in her backyard. The only time we saw those 2 cats was when we looked up the giant tree. The 2 cats were always sitting at the tip top of it. Talk about survivors. Those cats knew if their paws ever hit the ground, they'd be goners. Out of Mrs. Wilson's 40 cats, Mamie and Bullet killed 38 of them. Mrs. Wilson would walk over and say to Mama, "I don't know what's happening to my cats. They keep disappearing." Fortunately for us, Mrs. Wilson was about half deaf. Whenever anyone asked her about living next door to us, she always said, "Oh, they're the sweetest boys. They never make any noise. They're the quietest people you'd ever want to be around." Hey, you know what they say. See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil.
Once I reached down to pet a little dog, and when I did, it was a 5-pound squirrel.
Chapter 3. Redneck Pets. When we lived in the log cabin near Vivian, Louisiana, there were 2 big hickory trees in the front yard. If you've cracked open a hickory nut before, you know there's a green nut inside. Once you crack the thick shell or it pops off once it's ripe, the nut is as hard as a brick. My brothers and I had wars throwing those things at each other, and they really hurt. If you were ever hit in the head, it left a goose egg on your noggin. Until we were old enough to get a BB gun or some kind of firearm, we made slingshots and used the hickory nuts as ammunition. We'd take the inner tubes out of old tires and cut strips from them to use as slings. We found trees with forked limbs and tied the slings to the limbs with string. If you wanted a six gun, you used a limb that was about 6 inches long. If you wanted to be like Wyatt Earp and have a long barrel, you made it 12 inches. Then we took the leather tongues out of the old shoes and put the rocks and hickory nuts inside, for easy storage and carrying, ready to fire from the slings. We killed plenty of game with the slingshots, from squirrels to rabbits to blackbirds. We also made our own bows and arrows before we had rifles. We used thick reeds as our arrows, sharpened them, and then tied broad rocks to them for arrowheads. Anything that walked or flew was fair game. Mama raised chickens at our house, and they were always running around our backyard. One day, Phil and I were messing around in the yard with our bows and arrows when one of Mama's chickens ran across the yard in front of us. "Bad move, Jack." When the chicken made its way back to the other side, Phil fired an arrow and missed. On the second try, he hit the chicken right in the head. Phil and I grabbed the dead chicken and went down to the creek that ran behind our house. We plucked the chicken, built a fire, and roasted it for lunch. We knew we had to eat the evidence before Mama found out. We never told Mama we killed her chicken, but she knew one of them was missing. She figured a fox or stray dog killed it. Chickens weren't our only casualties. We used to hunt squirrels with our slingshots and bows and arrows. They've always been my favorite game to eat. But one time we found a baby squirrel that was still in its nest. Now, even I have a soft spot in my heart when it comes to young critters. We brought the baby squirrel home and fed it with an eyedropper. Somehow, the squirrel survived and became one of our pets. It crawled up on our shoulders and nibbled our ears every once in a while. Mama even allowed it to stay inside and roam around the house. We managed to keep the squirrel until the day Mama brought a new sofa for our living room. After we moved the sofa into our house, the squirrel crawled underneath it and wouldn't come out. It ate a hole through one of the boards and built a nest under the cushions. Every time someone sat on the sofa, a spring popped him in the butt because the squirrel had pulled out all of the cotton. I'd never seen my mama so mad. Needless to say, the squirrel was banished from the house and never allowed to come back. Being rednecks, squirrels weren't our only exotic pets. One day, Mama sent Phil and me to the store to buy a gallon of milk. On our way, we saw a flock of pigeons sitting on the roof of a cotton gin. We looked around and found a handful of flat rocks, we called them sailors, to hurl at the pigeons. Sailors are the best rocks to throw. If you throw them on water, they're really good skippers. "You throw first," I told Phil. "No, you throw first," he said. "When you throw, they're going to jump up, and then I'm going to get me one." I wound my arm back like Nolan Ryan and fired a rock at the pigeons. I knew I was fixing to nail one because I'd found the perfect sailor. As the rock made its way toward the cotton gin, I could see the pigeons getting anxious and fidgety. As the rock started its descent, they got really nervous. It was like artillery falling from the sky. You know what they say about nuclear war? All pigeons are cremated equally. Just about the time the pigeons jumped off the roof, my rock nailed one of them. Phil and I ran to the cotton gin and picked the pigeon up off the ground. My rock had hit him squarely in the head and somehow twisted his head around. The pigeon was looking straight back. The rock snapped his neck, but he wasn't dead. We had a pigeon coop at our house, so Phil and I carried the bird home, along with the gallon of milk. I put the pigeon in the coop, where it always sat on the top perch, his chest facing our house and his head looking behind him. I named the pigeon Eagle. Every morning I went to the coop to pet Eagle and feed him. When I took Eagle out of the coop and threw him into the air to fly, he flew straight into the ground and rolled over. How can you fly if you can't see where you're going? Bill and I used to throw him up into the air just for the fun of watching poor Eagle. Now, we found Eagle before Bullet and Mamie, our family dogs, ravaged Mrs. Wilson's prized collection of Siamese cats. One morning I woke up and went to the coop to feed our pigeons. As I walked down the hill, I was immediately struck with terror to see there had been a mass murder. There were blood and feathers everywhere in our pigeon coop. There were half-eaten carcasses lying on the floor. I set out to solve the crime. It's obvious that you can't spell NCIS without Si, and that's me. After combing through the evidence, I concluded the crime was a catastrophe. Out of 25 pigeons, Mrs. Wilson's cats had killed every one, except Eagle. Eagle was still sitting on the top perch, his chest facing me and his head looking the other way. The only thing I could figure was that the cats were superstitious and were afraid to kill him. Or maybe Eagle had eyes in the back of his head and managed to fend for himself.
When you were born and they were handing out brains, you thought they said trains.
Chapter 4 Book Report. After Jimmy, Frank, and Harold left for college, Tommy, Phil, and me went everywhere together. We were inseparable. I'm not sure Tommy and Phil wanted to drag their little brother everywhere they went, but Mama didn't give them much choice. If they were leaving to play football, going fishing, or hunting, or going to town, Mama always told them, "Take little brother with you." Tommy, Phil, and I were like stair steps everywhere we went. Tommy always walked in the front, and he was about 4 inches taller than Phil. I walked behind Phil, who was 4 inches taller than me. Since I was the youngest brother, I always brought up the rear. When Mama would get tired of us, she'd load us up in our Ford Falcon and drive to Belcher, Louisiana, which was about 10 miles from where we lived and was where we went to middle school. She'd drop us off at the Red River Levee and say, "Go catch us a mess of fish. I don't want to see y'all until supper time." Basically, Mama was letting us know that she was tired of us and needed a day off. Hey, if I spent most of my adult life around 5 boys, I'd need a vacation every once in a while, too. When Mama dropped us off, we'd follow the river back toward our house. We'd usually float down the river on a log for about 5 miles, get off where the river started to make an S-curve around a bend, and then walk the last 2 or 3 miles to our house. We were always exploring that river like we were in a Huckleberry Finn adventure. If we were at the river, we were usually fishing. We used to throw lines on the river, and it was a 3-man operation. We used a brick and nylon rope with hooks. We could make the throw line however long we wanted to make it, as long as it was short enough for us to control. We usually went with 12 hooks on each throw line. We cut a thick branch off a willow tree and drove it into the ground. Then we tied the throw line to the top and bottom of the branch. Before we were ready to fish, 2 people had to catch live bream and carry them in a wash tub full of water. One of us was in charge of throwing the brick and rope into the water, making sure not to hook ourselves in the process. After we hooked ourselves several times, we finally used our brains and learned to make the rope between the last hook and the brick long enough so it wouldn't hook us. While one of us was throwing the brick into the water, somebody else had to hold the rope at the willow branch, making sure the throw line didn't slap the water and knock the bait off the hooks. The 3rd person was in charge of making sure each of the 12 hooks always had fresh bait on it. Usually, we set out 4 or 5 throw lines on the river at once, so we'd have as many as 60 hooks in the river at the same time. Let me tell you something. There's not a finer sight than seeing a willow branch shaking back and forth because there are so many fish on your throw line. We used to get so excited running to the lines, pulling in 15-pound blue catfish. We also caught Opelousas catfish and high-fin blue catfish. We'd come home with 3 wash tubs full of catfish. It was fish fry time. The whole neighborhood would come over to eat when they smelled the grease at the Robertson house. We supplemented whatever Mama and Daddy bought at the grocery store with catfish, crappie, white perch, and the game we killed in the woods. Our fishing trips became legendary among our friends. During high school, we were required to read a book, write a book report, and then stand in front of the entire class and give an oral report on what we read. I was prepared to give a report on the adventures of Tom Sawyer, but when I stood up in front of my class, one of the other students said, "No, no, we've already read Tom Sawyer. We know Si and Phil skipped school last Thursday. We want to know what they did last Thursday." I looked at my teacher, Mrs. Jones, and asked, "Well, what do you think?" "Tell them what you did last Thursday," she said. "But know this, it better be good because I am grading you on this." So I proceeded to tell my class what I did the previous Thursday. Mama woke up early like always last Thursday and fixed us a good breakfast. But then she changed her mind and decided Phil and me weren't going to school. "I'm hungry for fish," she told us. "I want y'all to go catch me a mess of crappie." Phil and I started jumping up and down. Any day at the lake was better than spending a day at school. So Phil and I sat in the front room of our house, looking out the window for the school bus with our noses just above the windowsill. The bus stopped right between the shrubs in front of our house, and the bus driver opened the door and then blew the horn. Mama walked out and waved her on. Phil and I gave the bus driver just enough time to turn left at the end of our street, and then we ran out the back door to get our cane poles, wash tubs, and bait. We jumped in the Falcon and drove 15 miles to an oxbow lake on the Red River. We climbed into a boat that the man who owned the lake allowed us to use, and we were ready to catch some crappie. But when we got out on the lake, there was a north wind of about 30 miles per hour. It was a bad day to be fishing on open water. The lake had once been a channel of the Red River, but now it was landlocked and there were no trees to block the wind. It was wide open and we were paddling against winds of 30 miles per hour. When we finally reached our favorite spot to fish, Phil and I realized a commercial fisherman had recently been there. We saw 2 sticks in the water about 150 yards apart, and we knew that was where he'd tied off his net. Phil and I threw our lines into the water right there, and as soon as our shiners hit the water, we each caught 1.5 pounds crappie. By the time we had the fish in our boat, we were 150 yards away from the sweet hole. So we paddled against 30-mile-per-hour winds again, and then dropped our lines in the water and caught another fish. We looked up and we were 150 yards away from the sweet spot again. Finally, after about the 3rd time of doing this, Phil said, "Hey, this isn't going to work. One of us is going to have to paddle to keep us here while the other one fishes." Of course, I was the youngest, so I became a 3.5 horsepower human trolling motor to keep Phil between the sticks. Phil sat there and caught about 71 more crappie. We ended up with 75 crappies in our boat and then had one heck of a fish fry that night. After I finished telling the story, all of the kids in my class clapped. One of my buddies said, "That's what I'm talking about." I stood up from my chair and looked at my teacher. "C-," she said. "C-," I asked her. "Have you lost your mind? 75 white perch in 30-mile-per-hour winds, and I was the motor. You're giving me a C-." She looked at me and shook her head. "Hey, woman," I said, "I've got a news flash for you. That is an A+.
Hey, fear is a healthy thing.
Chapter 5. Unidentified Walking Object. There are only a few things in this world I fear. Poisonous snakes, losing my iced tea cup, not being able to take a nap, and being left alone in the dark. Hey, I'm man enough to admit that I'm afraid of the dark. I like the world better when it's light outside. You can see what's in front of you, or, more important, what's lurking behind you. I'm not actually afraid of the dark. I'm scared of what's in it, Jack. I'm not exactly sure when I was diagnosed with acluophobia, the fear of darkness, but I've always been afraid to be left alone in the dark. Growing up in the Robertson house, my older brothers always teased me about being scared of the dark. I spent many nights in bed with the covers pulled over my head while Tommy and Phil tapped on the walls or made scary noises to frighten me. I don't like to watch horror movies, and didn't even like to go trick-or-treating when I was a kid, unless we were back at our house before the sun went down. I always checked to make sure the doors and windows were locked, and the closets were clear before I went to bed. And I even slept with a nightlight until I left for Vietnam. Now I sleep with the TV on in our bedroom. I still don't like the dark. Whenever we went fishing or frog gigging at night when we were kids, Tommy and Phil liked to run off and leave me alone in the woods. I always feared that a grizzly bear, Sasquatch, or a 50-pound squirrel was going to eat me. Hey, you probably didn't know squirrels could grow that big, but I've seen them. They have razor-sharp teeth and don't look anything like the cute squirrels that eat nuts. They're man-eaters and like to gnaw on human bones. They'd probably like nothing more than to eat the hunters who are trying to shoot them, including me. I've been afraid of the dark for as long as I can remember. One night, Mama asked me to go outside to get her shoes, which she'd left on the front steps of our log cabin. "Mama, I don't want to go outside," I told her. "It's dark out there." Mama smiled and said, "Silas, you don't have to be afraid of the dark, son. Jesus is out there. He'll watch over you and protect you." "Are you sure he's out there?" I asked her. "Yes, Silas, he's always with you," she said. So I mustered up the courage to crack open the front door. I stuck my head outside. It was pitch black, and I could hear the grizzly bears and 50-pound squirrels stirring in the woods around our house. "Jesus," I asked while praying he would respond to my plea, "if you're out there, can you hand me Mama's shoes?" Well, Jesus never handed me her shoes, so I'm still afraid of the dark. Mama always told me my fear of darkness would go away once I got older, but it only seemed to get worse over the years. When I was in the fourth grade, Tommy, Phil, and I went frog gigging one night. After we'd gigged a bag full of bullfrogs, we started to make our way through the dark woods back to our house to clean them. We were walking in a straight line like we always did, with Tommy in the front and Phil in front of me. As we were walking through the woods, I kept hearing something walking behind me. Tommy had the flashlight, so I was trying to make sure that I kept Phil in sight. I didn't want to be left alone out there. No matter how fast I walked, I kept hearing footsteps behind me. After I heard the footsteps once more, I turned around and looked but didn't see anything. I figured I was only imagining the sounds because it was so dark in the woods, and hey, I was scared. The next time I turned around, though, I saw a pair of yellow eyes looking right at me. The eyes were glowing in the dark. I tried to muster up enough courage to scream, but my mouth was as dry as the Sahara Desert. I sat there in the woods, shaking and trembling in my boots, wondering what was about to eat me for dinner. Suddenly, I remembered a Bible verse Mama read to me. It was Isaiah 41:10. "So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand." I reached out for God's right hand but couldn't find it. So I looked for the next best thing, Phil's shoulders. I took off running and ran right into Phil's back, and then he fell into Tommy. We fell into a clump on the ground. "Hey, hey," Tommy yelled. "Si, what's going on?" "There's something behind me," I screamed. "It's Sasquatch." Tommy shined the flashlight back to where I'd seen the unidentified walking object. We didn't see anything. "You're imagining things," Phil told me. "You're such a sissy." But when Tommy shined the light back to the spot again, we saw a big blur run past us. It jumped into a large covert to our left. "I told you there was something back there," I said. We slowly tippy-toed toward the covert and shined the light down into it. We didn't see anything, but we were suddenly overcome by the putrid scent of a skunk. It smelled awful. "Si, it was only a skunk," Phil said. To this day, Tommy and Phil still contend I only saw a very large skunk. Hey, I don't know about you, but I've never seen a skunk that walks upright and is 4 feet tall. Even now, I still have no idea what the unidentified walking object really was. It had eyes that glowed in the dark and walked just like we do. It fell in line right behind us as we walked through the woods. Maybe it was a 4-foot skunk. We grow 'em pretty big down in Louisiana. Or maybe it really was Sasquatch, and he badly needed a bath.
"He's like a snake in the grass. Hey, if you chop its head off, it'll still bite you."
Chapter 6. Snake Bit. One of the biggest hazards of living in Louisiana is that nearly 40 different species of snakes are here. Where I live, snakes hide under rocks, logs, floor mats, and pillows. Hey, they even sleep in your boots. If you're not careful, they'll crawl into your pocket when you're walking to the duck blind and back. Heck, I have to check my gun barrel every time I shoot to make sure a snake didn't crawl into it. As you may can guess, I don't like snakes. The only good snake is a dead snake. If anyone tries to mess with me when it comes to snakes, they're going to have a fight on their hands. Given as much time as I've spent in the woods hunting squirrels, birds, deer, and other game, along with being on the water fishing and shooting ducks, the odds were pretty good I was going to be bitten by a snake. In fact, I've been bitten by a snake 27 times in my life, to be exact. Over the years, water snakes, pine snakes, blind snakes, brown snakes, garter snakes, ribbon snakes, rat snakes, racers, and king snakes have bitten me. Hey, I don't blame the snakes. That's what a snake does. They're snakes. Looking back, it's amazing that a poisonous snake never bit my brothers or me. I guess Mama was right. Someone was always watching over us. Northwest Louisiana, where we grew up, is one of the few places in the United States that is home to all 4 of the venomous snakes of North America. The copperhead, cottonmouth, coral snake, and rattlesnake. We're even blessed to have 2 kinds of rattlesnakes, the canebrake and the eastern diamondback. Boy, aren't we lucky. You always have to be on the lookout for snakes. You never know when one is going to be lying in the path of your next step as you're walking through the woods or swamp. Fortunately, Phil detests snakes as much as I do, so there are always 2 sets of eyes scanning the ground for them. My brothers and I had plenty of close calls when we were kids. One day, while we were running on a sandbar on the Red River, Tommy stopped dead in his tracks. What followed next was like something out of a cartoon. Phil bumped into Tommy, and I ran into Phil's back. It was like dominoes falling over. We landed about 6 inches from a big snake. "Whoa, whoa," Tommy screamed. "It's a king cobra." We looked down and saw a big black snake on the ground. It was standing on its tail with its head flared up. The king cobra was staring straight at us and looked ready to strike and send us to our graves. We stepped back and the snake backed down. It curled up on the ground and its head returned to normal. "No, I've seen a picture of one of these snakes in a book at school," Tommy said. "It's not a king cobra snake. It's a hog-nosed snake." Since it wasn't a king cobra that could kill us with one strike, Tommy caught the snake with his bare hands. It kept flaring its head at us while we played with it. It was a bad-looking thing. When it calmed down, its head looked like it had a pig's nose with big nostrils. But when it flared up, it was wicked-looking. One summer, we learned we could sell dewberries for about $5 per gallon bucket, so we went into high gear gathering them. We went anywhere to find them. Dewberries are closely related to blackberries and raspberries, but they're bigger and grow on trailing vines that look like weeds. We sold them to women who used them to make cobblers, jams, or pies. We always saved enough for Mama to jar or turn into a Sunday cobbler. $5 a bucket was a lot of money for boys who never had much money in their pockets, so we searched for them day and night. We kicked it into high gear, Jack, and we went to picking dewberries fast and furious. After a few weeks, we tapped out our sweet hole, so we went searching for more brambles of dewberries. We walked down the levee at the Red River looking for dewberries along the bank. At the bottom of the incline, Tommy spotted some dewberries. "Hey, we have to get down there," Tommy told us. "If there are dewberries down there, they're going to be big because they're close to the water." Sure enough, we found some dewberries. We were on one knee wading through water picking dewberries at the edge of the river. They were as big as 50-cent pieces. I was counting the money we were going to make in my head. Phil and I filled our buckets in about 3 minutes. When Phil and I were finished, we walked back to the top of the levee, which was about 6 feet above the water at a 45-degree incline. Phil looked down at Tommy, who was still on one knee. Right above him on the bank were two big black rings with a white spot in the middle of them. The rings were 4 inches from Tommy's leg. It was two cottonmouth water moccasins, which are some of the meanest and deadliest snakes you'll come across. The snakes were about as big as my arm, about 4 inches in diameter. They looked like they could kill an 800-pound bull. "Tommy, look down at your right knee," Phil yelled. I heard Tommy scream, and the next thing I knew, Tommy was standing between Phil and me. Both of our mouths just dropped open. He jumped 6 feet from the water to the top of the hill. I never saw Tommy run up the hill. He was at the bottom of the hill, and then he wasn't. After catching our breath, we found big sticks and killed the two snakes. "Hey, I've got to figure this out," Tommy said. Tommy is smart and always has to have a logical reason for why something happens. He went back into the water where he was kneeling, jumped up, and ran up the hill. It took him about 6 seconds. He tried to jump out of the water, but he could only jump about 3 feet. Then he went to the top of the hill, ran down, and jumped, but it wasn't much further. No matter how much Tommy tried, he couldn't duplicate the feat. Now, I've read several stories about hysterical strength and how adrenaline allows humans to do things they normally couldn't do. In 2011, a University of South Florida football player named Danis Estenor lifted a 3,500-pound Cadillac Seville off a tow truck driver who was pinned under its rear tire. In 2006, an Eskimo woman named Lydia Anguille distracted a 705-pound polar bear long enough for hunters to arrive and rescue her 7-year-old son and 2 other children. And in 1982, a Georgia woman named Angela Cavallo lifted a 1964 Chevrolet Impala off her son after 2 jacks fell. Now that's a muscle car. I don't know what the Olympic record is for the standing broad jump, but my older brother broke it that day. Those 2 cottonmouth water moccasins put springs in his knees.
You put camouflage on anything, and it automatically becomes cool.
Chapter 7. Floating Log. Hey, remember what I said about snakes being everywhere in Louisiana? Newsflash, snakes aren't even the state reptiles of Louisiana. It's the alligator. If you're walking through a swamp, lake, or river and don't step on a snake, chances are you'll step on an alligator. Bad news, Jack. The alligator is one mean sucker, and hey, it's a cold-blooded animal. I've seen alligators that are 20 feet long and weigh more than 1,000 pounds. They'll eat fish, rats, crabs, birds, beavers, muskrats, raccoons, ducks, deer, and Milo the family dog. In Vietnam, I once saw an alligator wipe out an entire village on the Dong Nai River. It wasn't a pretty sight. A snake's bite might kill you, but it sure beats getting locked in the jaws of death. Alligators live to be about 50 years old in the wild, and there's a reason they've survived for so long. They're the baddest predators in the swamp. They'll go through nearly 3,000 teeth killing their prey before they die. When one tooth falls out, another one grows in its place. Nothing else has the courage to mess with them. Hey, how many arms does an alligator have? It depends what it ate for dinner, Jack. There are nearly 2 million alligators living in Louisiana, and I suspect more than half of them reside in our duck holes. I've been running from alligators since I was a young boy. Mama taught me early that I could become an alligator's appetizer if I wasn't careful. We've never really hunted alligators because we don't like to mess with them, but we're always mindful that one might be lurking close when we're in the duck blind. Some time ago, I decided I wanted a pair of alligator boots.